This is the biggest interview since Frosty Nixon.
Frosty Nixon?
I mean, in 10 years, Ron Howard's gonna make a movie out of this. We do this, we can interview any president on the planet. And then you can ask him the real questions. This is like eating our vegetables. Once you eat those, then you get to eat the steak. And we know Aaron wants his steak. This is like the Lord of the Rings, okay? I'm actually like Frodo Baggins. You're my Sam. My Samwise. I can't do it without you.
Okay.
Come with me to Mordor.
Okay, let's do it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm managing editor Matt Goldberg, and with me today is senior editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
This will be our last Collision of 2014, so thank you for joining us. We'll be talking about three films today. We'll be talking about Angelina Jolie's Unbroken, Rob Marshall's Into the Woods, and Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg's The Interview. We will be getting to those in that order, so if you came to listen to the interview, you're going to have to stick to the end and hear us talking about Unbroken and Into the Woods, which is good, because there are things to talk about this film. We're going to lead off with Unbroken, a film that I thought was quite terrible. I found it to be misguided at best and really disturbing at worst. And I feel that I don't want to chalk it up to inexperience on Angelina Jolie's part. I also would like to note I haven't seen her first film, In the Land of Blood and Honey. I think really this is a screenwriting problem, more than anything. Or, not more than anything. But at the same time, my problem with Unbroken is, here's the story of Unbroken, as presented by the movie. Luca Zamperini is a Olympic runner. He goes to fight in World War II. His plane is shot down. He survives at sea for 47 days with a couple other guys are at sea with him, and it goes from bad to worse when, yes, they are picked up, but it's by the Japanese Navy. So then Lewis then gets thrown into a Japanese POW camp where he's targeted by a sadistic overseer. This half of the film is largely Lewis getting the shit kicked out of him. That's really all there is. He just gets beaten and beaten and beaten. And then he is unbroken because he gets out. Because he survives. He survives getting the shit kicked out of him for an hour. And to me, I find it kind of despicable that it applies the if you can take it, you can make it rah-rah cheer of do good at running to survive prison camp. That I just find very upsetting. And then I find it more upsetting that apparently the book spends a large portion after he gets out about him trying to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder and then forgive his captors. And I find that a fascinating story. And that is not in this movie. And I went over all that in my review. Adam, what do you think of Unbroken?
I kind of liked it. I went into it hearing all the negative buzz or mostly underwhelming buzz about it, and I as well have not seen Angelina Jolie's first film. I think that its greatest flaw, and you touched on this in your review, is that Louis Zamperini is portrayed as a saint, and saints are boring. The character, my biggest problem with this movie is that I had no emotional attachment to the character. So I was watching these harrowing things happen to him and I was like, this is pretty awful and this is pretty terrible. But I was never emotionally torn up about it or like, I don't know, I didn't feel a physical connection to what was going on. It felt as if I was watching the story play out. And it seems as though there is a lot more to Louis' story that's in the book. And this is the problem with a story so big and sweeping and incredible such as Louis, is that it's tough to turn it into a movie. It's tough to pin that down into a self-contained story arc with a beginning, middle, and end, and themes and stuff like that. And I don't think that Jolie successfully turned it into a good movie. I thought it was fine. I thought it was interesting. I did not at all pick up on the theme of it being physical strength is what got him through the war. To me, it was more a story about this guy who's been in the public eye and lived his life with people watching him and with knowing that his actions have repercussions for those around him. And so to me, more of the story was him trying to be there for everyone else. He was doing things, I mean, I don't want to get into spoilers, but there's a portion in the POW portion of the camp where he's faced with a choice of what he can do to possibly make his time better. And I think if we could have gone into the mental, you know, the conflict, the internal conflict in making that decision and what was going on would have been much more interesting, because I feel like he's making all of these actions for the sake of those around him and for the sake of keeping everyone else going and not just himself.
I agree that there's this turning point, and I wish, I'm with you, I wish they had gone more into it, because when I see this turning point, I know, and not just from the trailers, I never, even if I hadn't seen the trailers, I had no doubt he wouldn't have gone with that, because he's a saint. He's not going to do that. He's not going to wrestle with anything. That's the thing.
That's the thing, is you don't see that conflict. You don't see a struggle, or an internal struggle. You don't see flaws. I feel like we should have, and again, this is the problem of making this movie, it's hard for me to sit back from my perspective of sitting and watching this. I can't sit here and tell you what to cut out, because you need all that time.
I can. I think you can cut down on the time in the ocean. I think you can cut down on the time in the POW camp, because that stuff gets eventually redundant. We know that it's bad and it's painful out there. And I think that the film, rather than driving it and rather really plunging you down, eventually plateaus. And I think really at that point the film is languishing in things that are physically tough, but they aren't pushing an emotional core of this character. And I would also like to say Jack O'Connell is a good actor, and this role does not showcase his talent in the way that 71 or Startup does.
Yeah, I was a little underwhelmed. I mean, the cast in this movie is really good. You have Garrett Hedlund, Donald Gleason, even Finn Wittrock. Like, everyone in
you
it is
You have Jai Courtney's giant head showing
up. And I think Jai Courtney's a fine actor. He gets a lot of shit for it, and like, everyone compares him to Sam Worthington. Sam Worthington is the blandest actor on earth. I think Jai Courtney is fine. But
I feel the exact opposite way regarding those two actors. But go on.
We shall have a battle. We should they should release an action movie with Jai Courtney versus Sam Worthington to see who can be interesting.
Actually, that's going to be the sixth Terminator movie.
Oh God, it's going to be a Terminator Die Hard mashup.
Well, I mean, Jai Courtney's in New Terminator. It'll be
and Sam Worthington was in the other Terminator.
Exactly. That's why it's going to be all Terminator and all not giving a shit.
But yeah, this I don't know. The movie was gorgeous. I mean, you don't expect anything less from Roger Deakins.
But should it be gorgeous? I guess.
See, I don't think it needs to be mired down, and I don't think it was a matter of making things look pretty. It's just the way Deakins chooses to shoot these scenes, where he chooses to put the cameras. I don't think he's glorifying anything. I think it's just kind of, you're seeing the uniformity of these POW camps. You're seeing the lack of individuality from an outside perspective in these wide shots of everyone down there. But
I just feel like everything is just immaculate. In a sense.
I didn't feel that way. I didn't feel like
I just I feel like I know I'm watching Roger Deakins at work, and I think he's a masterful cinematographer, but what I feel are either the choices that are being made for this movie to me don't click with the story. They click more with I'm going to make a very presentable, uplifting tale that I hope gets me in the awards race. It has an award sheen to it. It's like, because this story is uplifting and I don't understand what's uplifting about it, I think that's part of my disconnect. The film thinks it's uplifting, it's about perseverance, but I am not feeling it. I just see a very pretty thing of a guy getting beaten a lot.
I don't know. It's a weird movie. I think, honestly, I think the biggest problem with it is the direction. And not just, I mean, I've seen people in comments saying, what exactly does a director do? But I feel like in this instance, when you hire Roger Deakins, he's going to make things look great. But it takes a strong director with a very specific voice to say, this is what I want from you, Roger Deakins, as opposed to, you know, do your thing. It's going to look, you're going to compose fantastic shots. But I don't feel like there didn't seem to be a strong point of view of like, what are we going for here? What is this supposed to be?
See, what I flash back to, and probably because it's recent, is Prisoners, where Dennis Villeneuve, like, Prisoners is not, it's beautiful, but it's not, it's brooding, it's atmospheric, it's not a pretty film.
Yeah, but that is an instance of a specific, that's like Dennis Villeneuve knew exactly what he wanted from it. It's not, and I would agree with you saying that, like, it's not Roger making things gorgeous. He's kind of, he's in this moody, rainy Pennsylvania backdrop, and everything is mired in uneasiness.
Right. And with Skyfall, everything's sleek and sexy. I feel Roger Deakins can do anything, but you need a director who knows the language to say, here's the story I'm telling and here's how I want it to feel. I feel that Angelina Jolie has Roger Deakins on standard setting, which is you can make anything look amazing.
Yeah.
The question is, well, why should this film look amazing? What personality are you trying to convey to me with Unbroken?
Sure. But I mean, again, as I was sitting there watching it, I couldn't really pinpoint anything that I was never bored, but I was never extremely compelled. And yet, at the end of the day, I don't necessarily think it is a bad film. I think it's a fine movie that I probably won't think about that much.
I just feel like it's something where I feel that in its drive to be uplifting, it really shies away from anything that's difficult or messy. And that's especially problematic in a war movie. This is a PG-13 film. And no one swears, and there's pretty much no blood. And to me, it's very polished. And I feel that the polish is really drags down all the drama of it. Again, I feel that this movie was primed for glory and primed for prestige rather than what is the story we're trying to tell. It's like, here's this book, it's a bestseller. Everyone loves it. It's gift wrapped. Well, that should be easy.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. It's not, I mean, there's a lot to fit in, but the question is what do you focus on? And I feel that there were good things to focus on, but I didn't see those because I think that this quest for forgiveness, that's messy. And I think that ultimately is more uplifting because I see the moral and inner conflict of it. And that really puts it on the shoulders of a character rather than, oh, he's going to get beaten with a stick again.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think, and that's, I could draw parallels to another movie, another war movie that is out right now or coming out right now that's poised for awards thing that it's more compelling in its epilogue and postscript than it is in the actual film. And that there's a lot of stuff, like that stuff I would have been really interested to see. Gosh, I don't know what the fix is because for me, I needed those ocean set scenes to establish.
But did you need all of them? Did you need all of the ocean?
I think I understand the point of them. I understand the point is to get across, man, like once they're picked up by the Japanese, the point is they have been through so much already and it hasn't even started. Like the terribleness hasn't even begun yet. So I understand to see all of that stuff at sea, it starts to get like, it's not just kind of like, oh man, they got really skinny. It's, you're in it with them and it becomes, I think the point of it is that it's monotonous and that it's, they're kind of in this oasis of like, there is no end, like what happens? And then to go from that to, oh, and now I have a whole new hell to live through. Like things have gotten so much worse than when we thought it was at the worst.
I will agree with you on them being lost at sea, and I actually do think that's the more compelling half of the film. I actually think that's more interesting, especially because I think when you have O'Connell and Gleason basically carrying the film, because it's three guys in a boat. Mm-hmm. I think that's actually kind of interesting. I think that's because there's nowhere to go. It has to be the characters. You're in a freaking life raft.
Yeah.
Battling the elements. I think that's really compelling. I think once you reach the POW camp, though, how much further can you really go? Like,
yeah, and also he becomes almost like a supporting character at parts. It's kind of he gets Bilbo'd in it and into some portions of it when there's other stuff going on, but it's not really other. Like, you start to think, oh, there's some other stuff going on.
Also, like, we're gonna turn Bilbo into a verb now.
Yeah.
For main character getting sidelined.
Yeah. But yeah, there are points where you're like, oh, what's going on with Garrett Hedlund? And then it's like, oh, that's not really anything. And I don't know. And, you know, for the advanced buzz, I mean, this goes to show about what advanced buzz really means, is that everyone's like, oh, like, apparently Maya V is incredible in the, like, Tormentor role, and he's fine. Like,
this is how studios...
He's unremarkable.
This is how studios whisper in the air of Oscar bloggers.
Yeah.
You have to understand that Oscar bloggers are not in a void. They are very much in communications with the studios, who will pay money to put ads on Oscar blogger sites. And that's how Oscar bloggers make six figures.
I wouldn't rope all of them into that.
I'm not going to rope all of them into it. It's up to
Oscar bloggers to discern.
Of course. I'm not saying that. But at the same time, let's be very clear that there is a conversation going on.
Yes.
And that when an Oscar blogger says, you know, Miyavi, oh gosh, best supporting actor contender right here, really? we don't know anything. Someone told you that. That seems unlikely that you know that already. So I feel that with Unbroken is a test case in hype. That's what I would point to it.
That being said, though, I still do not think it's out of the question for it to be Best Picture nominee.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's it. I mean, I think you could look at a Les Mis situation where you come late in the year and you've already got the prestige behind you. You have 9 slots.
It's almost like, well, I already had it in here. I might as well just keep it there for people who are voting for Oscars. I already planned on voting for this as Best Picture before I saw it. I might as well keep it in the tin.
I want Jolie to like me. I want that, and I don't want to vote against Uplifting. I think that that's the thing. There's the Uplifting edge where the sort of the incredibly loud, is it, I forget the name, extremely loud and incredibly close.
Yeah.
Where it's like, this is Uplifting, so 9th slot. Like, it's just sort of there, and it's like, why do you hate Uplifting things?
See, but, and I honestly did not feel like Unbroken was that uplifting to me.
It's not, but it plays itself off that way, I think.
It didn't really play
because
itself off
unbroken.
That way to me. It was just, I don't know, just kind of like, here's a fascinating story.
It's a fascinating story, but again, like, the film saves everything that's interesting about it for the postscript.
Yeah.
Everything that's interesting about that film is in the end credits.
Sure.
But that end credits is, like, meant to, like, you know, make you feel good. Things turned out okay. You know, when you write, he worked through post-traumatic stress disorder, you are basically negating post-traumatic stress disorder. Oh, I'm glad he got through it. They wrote it, and it's on it. It's in a sentence.
I can't believe I'm saying that Clint Eastwood is besting Jolie in American Sniper by at least, like, showing a tiny sliver of PTSD in American Sniper.
Sliver of PTSD is he's occasionally startled by live noises.
He leaves most of that to the postscript, but he gets into it a little bit as opposed to... But again, Unbroken, this book is huge. And, like, a little side note, I was... Everyone was like, oh my gosh, I'm so shocked that Unbroken made all this money. Like, are you kidding me? This book was a massive bestseller. What have we not learned from Gone Girl, Fault in Our Stars? People who love books are going to the movies.
I'm personally surprised people love books. That was my takeaway. Reading.
It's just kind of like, well, it didn't have good reviews. That doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, American Sniper is going to do the exact... It's going to make a ton of money because that book was on the bestseller list for...
Lone Survivor did really well, and they're being timed right. They're being timed right to land in this January wasteland where what else are you going to go see?
For sure. And I'm honestly, I haven't read Unbroken, but I would really like to read it now because I've heard so many great things about it, and there's so...
Yeah, I have nothing
against
the book.
There's so much of Louis's story to tell, and this was a movie that, like, Universal knew, I don't know if it was always at Universal, but they knew they had a gold a gold nugget. They just had to figure out how to get it out of there, and I don't think they got the gold nugget out of. I mean, they had this golden source material. How do you like find a movie in there? And I don't think they found the best movie.
I would
out of
love to read the Coen Brothers script for this. Because
they were the first credited screenwriters. This
I know they're the first credit ones, but like, I mean, Richard Grievenis.
Yeah,
that's it. I'm curious about the changes he made.
No, he didn't. I'm saying the Coen Brothers were the last ones on.
They were the last ones on this.
Yes, like they are the top credited screenwriters, and that they did the most work on it. Like
and
the initial screenplay was by Bill Nicholson.
Sure.
And then LeGravenis came in, and then when Jolie came on, she brought the Coen brothers in to polish it.
And to me, even based on that trajectory, though, I want to read the development of these screenplays. Because,
sure.
Like you're saying, there's so much here. What do you choose? And I'm also curious about the conversations between Jolie and screenwriters to see, like, what did you want from this? And
yeah.
I think, you know, after looking at this and looking at Gambit, I think we've sort of come to the conclusion that Coen Brothers as screenwriters is kind of not Coen. Like, they're
Apparently they're very good at hiding their voice. Like, they're very good at being hired guns if they need
exactly. them. So their names become kind of meaningless.
Yeah, they will do what they are hired to do. Like, they know character, they know plot, they know how to, like, the director tells them what they want. Here is what you wanted. Like,
yeah.
Here's the screenplay that you
and
wanted.
And that's the thing. If this is what Jolie wanted, if this is what the studio wanted,
yeah,
you know, take the money. I'm sure it was good money on Unbroken. And
sure.
Just do that. But what they came up with was, I just found that it got really loathsome. I feel like its approach to war got really kind of is where I really got off board with it. And the relentless sadism of the bird against.
See, I didn't really feel that relentless sadism, and maybe it's because maybe it's because everyone was talking about it so much going in that I was expecting much more. But
okay.
I mean, there was of course there were beatings, but to me it didn't ever feel gratuitous or torture pornish.
Yeah, I mean I mean for me I really didn't know what to expect. I mean, I knew that there were beatings, but man, I felt they just went on. I felt I can't really remember anything else about the POW stuff.
If nothing else, we have that incredible shot by Deakins of towards the end of the POWs and then the shadow of the plane flying over. That's just an incredible shot.
That's Deakins for you. Give him another nomination, and he
will
win.
He's doing Jolie's next movie, an Africa set movie, and I don't even care what the movie's about. It's Roger Deakins is shooting Africa, so I'm there.
Has he done a movie that he's shot in Africa before?
I don't think so.
No, well, I mean, that's the thing. You got Deakins in your back pocket. You've got something.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you want to move on to talking about Into the Woods?
Let's talk about musicals.
Into the Woods. Adam, what do you think about it?
The longest opening song in movie history.
It's great.
The opening song lasts a full act, it feels.
It's 15 minutes. It's
yeah,
a 15-minute thing, and it's because you have four storylines.
Yeah. I liked Into the Woods. I didn't love it, and I'm a big fan of movie musicals, so I was not disappointed, but a bit underwhelmed, I guess I would say.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
But I enjoyed it. What I liked about it is that it feels like a musical. A lot of movie musicals, or I should say adaptations of stage musicals, they're like, let's get rid of this stage stuff. Let's make it feel like a movie. And what I like about Rob Marshall, who has made one of the best movie musicals of all time with Chicago, is that he does not do that. He's like, I'm gonna make the stage musical into a movie, but keep what made the stage-iness of it intact. And that's Into the Woods. Very much feels like you're getting that stage musical treatment on a larger canvas with a bigger production value.
See, for me, Chicago, which I agree is fantastic, the staginess of Chicago works because it always ties back to the fact that there was the club at the beginning. So there is a stage organically put into the plot.
Sure.
With Into the Woods, when I learned that the film had the budget of $50 million, I'm like, oh, that's why it looks kind of cheap. Like, I mean, it's stretched, but not far. I mean, to to me, it's like if you give this movie more money, you can really take advantage of the magic of it. But with not with but without a lot of money, you're kind of on the sets. Like I was very aware I was on sound stages with this film.
Yeah.
Very.
Well, and aware. I know it was. They were very tight on budget, but I think it kind of works because it keeps that charm of the staginess of it, and it's the woods, so it's not. I mean, it does feel a little cheap, but it's not like, ugh, they could have gotten so much bigger. I mean, it's the woods.
But let's back.
More are you going to do with it?
Sure, but maybe instead of just being the woods, I'm not saying, like, make it a special effects extravaganza, although when it does try to be special effects, I think the song that sort of catches me is Giants in the Sky, and you have, like, Jack climbing this big CGI beanstalk, and then he's, like, back on a soundstage, like, on the tiniest soundstage, climbing a tree. Like, it's like, okay, we don't have enough money to really do beanstalk stuff, so go in a tree. And it's cut together not that well. And for me, though, it's like the woods just look like woods. Like, it's just any woods. Like, just, yeah. Like, if we needed to, we could go on location, and we did at some points, to go into an actual wood. Instead of, like, what is the feeling of these woods? Do these woods feel mystical? Do they feel foreboding? Or have you simply changed the light filter?
I think it fits well because it's the claustrophobicness of it, the kind of long and winding road, where are we, what's going on? Because it is, at the end of the day, it's a character-centric musical. It's one that's not involved with, you know, visuals and big outer stuff. It's how these woods reveal who these people really are, and not change them, but kind of bring out the worst in them.
But I feel like the woods can be a reflection of that. I feel that Into the Woods is a movie is just so basic. Like, the first half is very bright and sunny, and then the second half is very overcast.
Yeah.
But the woods stay kind of the same. They're just like a place. Like, they're just, it could have been woods from anything. Like,
sure.
Not specific. They feel indistinct for this movie. They just don't have personalities. And I think just because this is a character-centric film, that doesn't mean the woods... I think it's important that the woods don't overshadow these characters. I don't think this should be Tim Burton's Into the Woods, where I'm only noticing, like, production design. But I also feel that there should be an exaggerated touch. That being said, the exaggerated touch of the wolf... God,
thank God it's basically a cameo.
Thank
but
goodness.
Again, I mean, it's so clear that this is budget stuff, and Rob Marshall said, I think the only way Disney would do it is that, like, get Johnny Depp and Meryl Streep, and he was like, okay, and he got them, and thankfully you get Johnny Depp so that you can put him in the trailer, and then that's it.
Yeah, and I think sell him to an international audience.
Yeah, and I think he did it the best way he could do, because it's not a major role. It's a role that's interesting because it has very... This is an interesting movie that Disney made it because it's a very dark play and a very adult musical. And I was kind of happy that they didn't shy away from that with the wolf song with Little Red Riding Hood and the sexual connotations of it.
Yeah,
I thought that was... I was relieved to see that kind of stuff was intact.
I think as a musical, Into the Woods is great. That's my problem with Nine, is I think Rob Marshall's Nine is beautifully shot, and the songs are garbage. The only good song from Nine is Be Italian. Everything else is terrible. Into the Woods, great songs. Just, they're all fantastic, and they all have deeper themes. Like, this is a musical with layers.
Yeah.
And I really like that. I think that it's just one of those things where I really wonder if he had more money, what he could have done. Because I feel that the nature of the fairy tale story lends itself to the fantastical. And when I see Chicago and I see all the neat things he's doing, like, you know, they both reach for the gun and then there's, like, all puppets in the background, or the sultriness of the cell block tango, and just sort of these angles he's playing with. Like, he is cool, like, using this heightened awareness. Like, he's not afraid of that. But strangely, in Into the Woods, there's not very much of it. There's not a lot of those kind of it's not a very stylized film. Or let me rephrase. It's not an overtly stylized film like Chicago or Nine.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But can we talk about Meryl Streep?
Because we can always talk about Meryl Streep.
She is phenomenal in this movie. And it's become kind of not cliche, but it's kind of like, oh, Meryl Streep, she always gets nominated, she's always great, but she is so good. Like, every time I forget how good she is. Just her introduction in this movie, the choices she makes in like the first 10 seconds of her screen time are so incredible and so just like, this is why she has so many Oscar nominations. Like, she is, there's nobody like her. And earlier when everyone was like, oh, she might get a Best Supporting Actress nod, and everyone was like, again, Meryl Streep. She totally deserving of it for this. She's fantastic.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Meryl Streep is the best. Look, and I'm not like on board, you know, like Meryl Streep deserves to win every time. I think that Viola Davis totally deserved to win more for The Help than Meryl Streep did deserve to win for The Iron Lady. But Meryl Streep is still a phenomenal actress who earns it. She's not coasting here. And the fact that she's still giving these kind of performances after decades in Hollywood, okay? She's like, there are some actors, you know, like Robert De Niro or Al Pacino, who are, you know, giving these performances, and you're just like, these guys, just stop. you're not really in it anymore. You're doing this for different reasons. You're doing it for paychecks. Meryl Streep is a consummate professional. She's taking roles consistently and then doing interesting things with them. And I'm completely with you on Into the Woods. I think, you know, the witch comes on screen and you think at first it's going to be kind of comical, but then there's a character, you know, it grow, you know, as we see more, we see she's very sad and very lonely and very angry. And just, there's, like you said, all these interesting choices that make a multi-dimensional character out of the witch. And kind of the witch is the most fascinating person in the film.
Oh, for sure. She's incredible. Like, from her first song to the last, she commands every scene she's in. My one complaint about it, and I'm not sure the way around it, is the CGification of her in the second half of the film, which is a little distracting in the shots that are from farther away. When it's close-ups, it's less distracting, but it's a little distracting when it's further away. But besides that, I think
yeah. Great. I mean, I think I
like,
agree
what
with
can
you.
Do?
I mean, I'm agree with you, but at the same time, I love that costume that she has in the second half. That's a great costume.
And Emily Blunt is great. Chris Pine is fantastic.
Of all the douchebag roles he's played this year, this is the best.
I saw someone saying that he's not. It's a role that's not too far from his Captain Kirk, because he's kind of playing off William Shatner's persona. I was laughing so hard during that agony
is a showstopper.
Oh yeah, and to think that Jake Gyllenhaal was initially gonna play Rapunzel's prince, that would have been really fun.
That would have been, I mean, Billy Magnuson is good, but put Gyllenhaal and Pine side by side to do agony,
that would have been incredible.
It really
Anna,
would have
Anna
been.
Kendrick's fantastic. The On the Steps of the Palace.
James Corden is great.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. It's one that I think I'll enjoy watching again on HBO and stuff. And the songs are great. And for people who don't live in New York City and get to see Into the Woods on Broadway or get to see him with great actress and stuff, it's fun to be able to see him like this.
Yeah, and this is the full story. A lot of people, as I've been talking to people about this movie, they say that when it's performed in high schools, they end it after the first half.
Yeah.
Except what makes this musical interesting is the second half.
The second half. And I know there are a couple of major departures from Sondheim's musical, but Sondheim kind of oversaw he was deeply involved in the movie. And worked on James L. Pine, who wrote the book for the musical, wrote the screenplay for the movie. So,
and credit to Rob Marshall that they did write new numbers for the movie, and they're like, these aren't working, and we're going to cut them. Because usually that's a go-to. It's like, hey, we got to get this Oscar nomination.
Yeah.
We got to add a song here. We need to add an original song, no matter how extraneous it is to what we're doing. And he's
did they do that for Les Mis? I can't remember.
Les Mis does. It does. It's the song that Valjean sings to Colette as they are leaving, as they are escaping in the middle of the night. And it, you don't remember it.
No.
At all. No one does.
It's just like, let's get a song in there.
Let's just squeeze a song in there.
What a movie. Such a movie that no one is talking about nowadays. I wonder if in 5 years, when you say Les Mis, people are going to be like, oh, yeah, the Liam Neeson one. Like, no, the musical. Oh, yeah, I forgot they did that.
I will always remember Les Mis as, like, I wanted to like that movie so badly. And on the one hand, you can never take away how good those songs are, ever. Yeah. Those are money in the bank. But it really, really makes me upset that that was our one shot at a Les Mis movie, and it's botched.
Yeah.
That upsets me.
We'll always have that trailer. That trailer's great.
We will always have that trailer. Oh, gosh. So, but yeah, Into the Woods. I liked that. I liked it. It was fun. It was, to me, when I went to go see it with my family on Christmas, I did not mind seeing it a second time. I liked it as much the second time as I did the first time. Yeah, it's not going to blow me away. Yeah, it didn't blow me away. It's not on my top 10 list. But I enjoyed it. And
it's perfectly enjoyable.
It was. And I was a bit wary. I was a bit wary after Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides and Nine. Yeah. And there was reason, and of course the fucking wolf costume, I'm like, oh no. But for the most part it works. For the most part.
And the wolf
works.
Costume kind of works to with what that character is and what that character represents. It's kind of in it. But there was a big to-do made of the fact that Into the Woods did not make the shortlist for makeup and hairstyling. A lot of people saying it was the CG of Meryl Streep. I think costume department is where this one shines.
I agree. It's great costumes. Really good.
And I just realized that when I was watching it, I was like, man, this kid playing Jack is fantastic. And I just realized that is the kid who played Gavroche in Les Mis, who was the best part of Les Mis. So.
That's the thing. I read somewhere that they're like, one of the worst things about this movie is that they use kid actors. I'm like, that's one of the best things about this movie is that use kid actors. If you use teenagers, it would lose a lot of impact because this movie is about parents and children. One of the songs is literally called Children Will Listen. Get more children. So I liked Into the Woods.
Yeah, nice movie. Looks like it's doing good business as well over the holidays. So Unbroken, Into the Woods, and The Hobbit.
So let's talk about a little different business, though.
Yes.
Let's talk about how things have changed with The Interview.
Indeed.
Well, before talking about all those ramifications, and last time on the podcast, so we recorded, and then the following day everything changed, because that's how this shit happens. We recorded Sunday night, and then Monday they're like, and then we're never going to release it all this way. And then we sighed. But the film was released in 300 indie theaters and on VOD, not only to rent, but also to buy. Mm-hmm. On VOD, which I thought was interesting. And it was released on YouTube. And most people were like, YouTube does videos? You can rent things on YouTube? It's like,
no,
yes,
idea.
You have, can, for a long time. It's just not known for that. And then Xbox and PlayStation, and then eventually iTunes. And
possibly Netflix. Apparently, Variety reported that they were in talks with Netflix.
They were in talks with Netflix. Apparently, they weren't in talks with themselves for Crackle.
No.
It happened this way, where it went to theaters and went to VOD, and this was the culmination of it. Strangely enough, even though the hackers were like, do not release this movie, it ended up coming out a day earlier than it was supposed to be released. Came out on the 24th. And people could watch it from the comfort of their homes.
Indeed.
This has been a remarkable piece of film history that we've just witnessed. The history is fascinating. The film itself. Adam, what did you think of The Interview?
I was disappointed. I loved This Is the End. It made my top 10. I thought it was inspired, brilliant, fantastic, hilarious, wonderful ending, which I only recently learned that ending was added after they had test screened it. And they were like, people want to see heaven. Let's get the Backstreet Boys in here. But no matter, it's still incredible. Yeah, I was a bit disappointed with The Interview. I laughed. It was funny. But as someone who really thought This Is the End was a breath of fresh air to the kind of modern state of comedy, this felt more standard, not formulaic, but a bit generic. And I think Franco is turned up to 14 in this movie when I think he should be at 11. He plays the role really broad, and I think it should have been reined in just a little bit, because sometimes it's just it was a bit over the top for me. I think Rogan's great. It's really not that blasphemous. It's kind of It's almost sympathetic to Kim Jong-un in some regards. It's such an odd thing that's happened, because now it's become this kind of bellwether, which we'll get to later. But as far as the film itself, I was a bit disappointed. I was really looking forward to it. I am still really looking forward to more from Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. I think directorially, and from a visual standpoint, this was a step up from this to the end, and I'm really eager to see their Preacher pilot that they put together for AMC.
The thing about the interview, first off, I like that Franco was going that big. And the more when I watch this film, I'm like, you know what? I kind of like Franco more in comedies than I do in dramas. And I think even though Franco does like a lot of like, you know, does his little art projects and adapts Faulkner and does these indies that no one watches or really cares about, I feel as if when he does comedy, like I'm looking at this, I look at This Is the End, I find he's the most charming in these kind of roles. Pineapple Express.
He's so good in Pineapple Express.
And I look at this film, and yeah, he's really cranked up, but Seth Rogen is really scaled back in this one a lot. It's really him just kind of taking a back seat for the most part. And then Randall Park is sort of the next comic force in the film, playing Kim Jong-un. But I thought it was the film I thought I was going to get. If I push all of the stuff surrounding the movie that arose because of the hackers and so forth, this is the film that the trailers basically led me to think I would get, and I was totally fine with that. It didn't change my world. It didn't upend my expectations. It didn't surpass them, but it was fun. I've heard this film compared to like a long SNL sketch, and I can kind of see where they are with that, but it's a sketch I laughed at a lot. It's a silly movie. It is a really silly movie, and I'm fine with that. I think it's juvenile. I don't think it's as good as Neighbors, which Rogan and Goldberg wrote, and I think Neighbors is great. This is a fun diversion. This to me was quality holiday season counter programming. It just happens to be at the center of a firestorm.
Yeah. I was together with family over the holidays, and my aunt was like, "Have you seen The Interview?" And I'm sure you get this too, and as probably people who listen to this podcast of older family members who think you know things about movies, they hear something. And my aunt, I'm sure, heard this from Fox News and was like, "I heard someone saying it was just the worst movie ever made. This lady was saying it was just terrible on the TV." And I was like, this is the thing. And I was like, this is the thing, is that people who would never in a million years see this movie are now seeing it because of this, which I think is a bad thing. Like, I would like to come out and say, like, it's great that it's coming out. Free speech is great. It is not your duty to see this movie. If you don't want to see this movie, don't see it. You know, patriotic duty to see
so
The Interview.
I understand the larger stakes of it. First off, it is something where we should be upset if terrorists tell us what studios are and aren't allowed to release. I find it very upsetting that Gore Verbinski's Pyongyang was just killed right off because of the repercussions of terrorists, because like, we don't, New Regency's like, we're not even going to do this. Nope, not going to do it. I find that very upsetting. That being said, I went to see it at the Plaza, which was one of the first theaters that stepped up and said, we're going to show this movie. And I was like, that's great. And I found out that even when the Plaza does something right, they can't do it right, because for 5 minutes before the film, they played God Bless America. And at first it was like, all right. And the crowd is chanting USA. And then after the movie, some are still chanting USA. And I'm like, why? Like, the more that played, I'm like, okay, let's calm the fuck down, people. This is entertainment, okay? Like, this is not an act of rebellion. We are watching fucking people talk. We're going to watch Seth Rogen shove something up his ass.
Yeah. This is not a movie that Greta Van Susteren would want to watch. Like, why is she reviewing this on air? Is my thing. Is that, like, stop going out and saying that it's so, like, not worthwhile because the movie's not good. Like, this movie wasn't made for you. Like, this is, if you had seen this trailer and you didn't want to see it, why would you want to see it now?
This trailer was not misleading.
No, it was not at all. It was exactly that movie. And if you are just watching like the first 20 minutes and turn it off, like it's clearly that it's the Rogan, like Franco Goldberg humor. Like it's what they've been doing for a decade now.
Right. This is not, he wasn't going to turn the page. And I mean, he could have, but this wasn't like a now to make a really sneaky, subversive satire against North Korea. That wasn't the film he wanted to make, and that's totally fine. He shouldn't have to feel obligated to make that movie, but don't be upset because he didn't make that movie. And you can, if this isn't your kind of film, that's fine. If it is your kind of film and it didn't work for you, that's also fine. Like, from what I'm gathering for you, Adam, you like this kind of movie. It's just this particular movie didn't work as well for you as you hoped it would.
Yeah, and also another thing is that it felt like a lot of the stuff was spoiled in the trailers. Like a ton of the cameos from This Is the End were kept under wraps, and that Backstreet Boys thing was kept crazy under wraps. Like that was shocking. But like all of the celebrity things were spoiled in trailers. The you know, like the Skylark interviews with like Rob Lowe, and maybe it was a consequence of the movie, of the heightened talk around the movie and controversy around the movie, because people were like, oh, it's not coming out, here's this YouTube video of the end of it.
Yeah,
here,
watch
the climactic scene.
That pissed me off.
Yeah, or like, oh man, I'm so pissed people won't get to see it because Eminem has a great moment where he comes out, and it's like, thanks for that.
I think we should have just warned people before we said that. But so then again, if you're listening to us talk about the interview,
go back and mute. No, go back and mute this. That's not fair. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that.
Let me mark that.
Cut this part out.
All right, hold on. Let me.
That was my mistake. I was just doing the thing I was railing against.
Fuck those guys. All right. Yeah, I will make an edit later. So I would say that it is frustrating because, and it was all, again, the thing about these cyber terrorists or terrorists, we're saying plural because they called themselves the Guardians of Peace, so it must be more than one person, and it's so sophisticated, and whether it was one person or whether it was many, this organization made the dumbest mistake by highlighting it. If they didn't want people to see the interview, if they didn't want people to care about the interview, they just should have let it go. They had no understanding of how the market works. It's not reverential of Kim Jong-un. Sorry. That being said, you, by putting more work into it, you made it a thing. You made it a thing.
Yeah.
You made it something that people wanted to watch and go out of their way to watch and started talking about it more and more and more to where you had really stupid people saying, I bet this is all a viral campaign from Sony. Like,
Team America is so much more inflammatory towards Kim Jong-il than the interview is towards Kim Jong-un.
It's more inflammatory towards everything. I rewatched Team America. True. Team America is ridiculously offensive. And it
hates
great.
It's offensive to everyone.
There is. There's a song called Everyone Has AIDS.
Yes.
And
if
it's
you watch
hilarious.
That movie and are not offended, then you are an alien. If you don't find one thing in that movie kind of like, then you're an alien.
Yeah, I mean, but you can do it. You can pull it off because there's also an extended scene of a puppet puking.
Sure, and it's not like I'm offended, like, screw this movie. It's just kind of like, man, they went there.
Well, and that was another scary thing of this whole issue where it's like there were threats against theaters and the hack. By leading with the hack, they did something that showed, you know, this is the level of our power. And then when these movie theaters like, you know what? Okay, well, we're going to show Team America. And then Paramount's like, you can't show Team America.
Which yeah, it's like, but you showed it 10 years ago? And it
you
was
showed
like,
it 10
like,
years
what?
Ago. Before this hack, you would have shown it 1 month ago. You would have had no problem if the theater was like, hey, to prepare for the interview, we're going to show you Team America. And if this had happened before the Sony Act, Paramount would be like, fine, whatever, show the movie, give us some money, and fine, we're cool. And that, you know, and by the way, I think Team America's on Netflix, but that's beside the point. The thing is now it's like everyone is saying, okay, well, we got to be careful not to upset the North Koreans. But, like, who's next? Who's next to say, what hacking group is say, don't do this, don't do that? Cybersecurity here is really fragile, and it's an ongoing arms race. Because every studio is going to beef up their security like crazy, and it won't matter because someone will come to tear it down again. And that's just the way it goes. It's a back and forth. And I'm not saying studios should give up on trying to protect themselves, but it's going to require a level of constant vigilance. And even then, they know that, and they are probably scared to say, you know, let's not push things too much. Let's not tempt fate. And if we're tempting fate, we don't want to make a movie that has anything to do with North Korea. And I find that very sad that that is now completely off the table. Even if the interview isn't good, that's beside the point. And that was something I found really frustrating in the lead up to it. It's like, and reviews have been poor. I'm like, what the shit does that have to do with anything? If the movie was good, then would it be, you know, worth, like, what? It's, first off, it's a subjective opinion. The movie is not good or bad on a fucking scientific scale. You don't have a formula to prove it. It's just, yes, it can get poor reviews, but again, that's missing the larger issue. And I found that very frustrating in the reports. Of also, something fun that I kept reading was, I haven't seen the movie, but I'm like, thank you for commenting on it.
Thank you for your insight.
Thank you. You've always very insightful and helpful. It's very important to have an opinion on the internet, even if it's uninformed.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, it exists, and I think more than anything, not only does it have implications for, studios and what might happen in the future, but also VOD market is not a joke. This is, without doubt, the largest VOD, the most high-profile VOD release in history that we've seen so far, and I do not think it's going to go away soon. I've already seen people saying that Universal is mulling over doing a day-and-date VOD release of 50 Shades of Grey, which would be genius. That's a brilliant marketing move.
Oh, for sure. I think that right now, before, the studios didn't really know how to handle VOD.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now it's like, okay, this is the market. This is where things are going. We're obviously not going to release a Marvel movie in VOD as a day and date thing. But let's start understanding this thing as, quite honestly, the future. Let's understand that from our perspective, it may be more cost efficient if we gear our efforts towards home viewing. This is where everyone wants to stay at home. And of course, in this whole interview disaster, leave it to the movie theater, big movie theater chains, to do something completely wrong-handed and say, you know what, don't come here.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, it was so tempting to come out and buy overpriced junk food from you. When now what you're telling people is, you could rent The Interview for $6, have all your friends over.
Hold on, those are Blockbuster prices, by the way. Like that's not even like a $13.99 like on cable on demand. Like $6 is cheap.
That's what I was so surprised, because usually like a VOD rental is like $10.
Yeah.
Like if I want to rent like the latest Joe Swanberg movie off iTunes, it costs $10 for Joe Swanberg in his house with his pals.
Don't pretend like you don't incessantly VOD Joe Swanberg movies.
Actually, the only one I've seen was Drinking Buddies, although I hear Happy Christmas is good. I've heard good things about that one. But the point remains that usually VOD films, like indie VOD films, are like $10. This one was $6. You could have invited all your friends over. You're on holiday breaks. They come over, watch The Interview, bring snacks. And now, to normalize it, then you can start pushing it. And then I completely agree with you. I think that 50 Shades of Grey is an ideal choice. And then you sort of start finding movies that are in that, like, that $20 million movie again, and maybe this will end up being a good thing. That sort of will get a certain kind of movie back that they don't make anymore, because under the current theatrical distribution model, there's no room for it. Because a multiplex has a limited amount of screens. Sure.
Though I would love to see, I mean, something like Gone Girl would probably fall under the VOD model if it weren't based on a best-selling book, but that's a movie that I relished seeing in the theater. So, I mean, on the one hand,
there's definitely a flip
side.
I don't
want to see the death of theaters, but I think that the success of The Interview on VOD definitely means that this is not the end, it's the beginning. I think that we will see much more of this. So, what that means for theaters, if they'll still do maybe like a limited sort of release, or, you know, the big theater chains were crazy against what studio was it who had Tower Heist was trying to do the Tower Heist day in
Universal was like trying to do a day and date Universal, and the movie theaters, you know, threw a shit fit. Well,
yeah.
Guess what?
They...
And Universal backed off. But guess what? You fucking pussied out now, and now it's been tested.
It got tested.
This would not have happened. This never would have happened if the major movie chains hadn't backed out. Sony did not pull this film, but not have backed out had the five major movie chains, and by the way, that's disturbing on its own that there are only five companies required to completely just get a movie to not be around anymore. That's fucked up. But you have these five chains, and they're like, well, we're not going to show it. And then they threw a shit fit later. They're like, well, we were going to show it eventually. It's like, you killed yourself, and you're terrible, and no one likes you.
Yeah.
It's true. I mean, they just don't... They are junk food dispensaries that happen to show movies. That is their business model. And it would have been one thing... Look, I understand that, you know, they don't want to be held liable. There was no credible threat, according to the Department of Homeland Security. If there had been a credible threat, it's like, okay, then we don't want to do that. I'm like, okay, I get it. Some official body that has the power to investigate these matters is telling you it's not safe. No one told you that. Instead, you wimped out, and forgive me, how many theaters were attacked of the 300 that showed this movie?
Zero.
Oh, zero. Zero. So it seems that the 9/11 threat from the cyber terrorists may have been an empty one. Yeah, it was complete horseshit and designed to scare people away. And yet this fear, you know, this scare tactic has, you know, as we said, it carried over to what Hollywood will and will not make. And I think that's unfortunate. This has been a game changer, not the film itself. No one will. Oh, maybe one guy is like, you know, I saw The Interview and it made me want to become a filmmaker. I don't know if that's going to happen. If the film itself will inspire people, but what surrounds it is film history.
Absolutely.
So, I think that's about it for The Interview. Adam, do you want to move on to recommendations?
Sure, let's do that. It was an interesting Christmas movie season, but with The Interview gone and stuff, and I did think that top five might have benefited from a boost of some sorts with another comedy gone, but the people seem to find things that they wanted to see, and with between Unbroken, Into the Woods, and Hobbit, so Annie bombed, so that was weird.
I'm the only person who liked Annie.
All of Will Gluck's films, I have seen the trailers and said, that looks stupid. And then I've seen the
Everyone
movie.
Was so mean to it.
They were so mean to Annie.
Poor little Annie. They were so mean to it. I think some people just... I don't know. I understand, like, the trailers were bad. I'll give you that. In fact, I think HitFix wrote some articles like 5-7 reasons the Annie movie will probably be terrible based off the trailer. I'm like, oh, fuck you. Don't do that for anything. And do it in list form. Fucking assholes. I'm sorry, it makes me angry. But people were mean to Annie. And I read other reviews because I was kind of fascinated because I went into Annie not expecting to like Annie. And I did. And I don't know, I feel like the arguments against it were just kind of expecting something that it never really set out to be. But that's a different story. But yes, Annie bombed.
Yes.
And he did bomb.
But I'll see it. I've liked all of Luke Luck's films thus far. They've all looked terrible.
It has my favorite it has my favorite inside joke of the year. Cool. I'll say that. It's a joke that only film nerds will get. And it's so fleeting. But Adam, you may already know.
Prize is a Moonquake Lake.
Okay. It's Moonquake Lake. It's related to Moonquake Lake. Yes. But yes, that's a good one. But that's not my recommendation this week. My recommendation is I know Christmas is over, but I feel we're in we're still in our Christmas grace period from Christmas to New Year's Eve. You know, that time where like it's still kind of okay to have your Christmas tree up.
It's up out of laziness, so, not out of a holding on to Christmas kind of thing though. It's just kind of like,
yeah,
I'm
but
not
where
gonna
it's
take
a grace.
It down
no, yeah, it's laziness, but no one judges.
No, you wait until you've had your New Year's Day hangover and you're like, the calendar says a different year.
Exactly.
I guess it's time.
But if you walked in, if you walked into someone's house and on the 27th and you saw their tree was still up, you wouldn't be like, come on,
no.
You asshole. Really? No, it's a grace period. And with that grace period in mind, and we still have a couple days left in that grace period, I'm going to recommend A Muppet Christmas Carol, which is on Netflix, and I had not watched since I saw it in theater, but I watched it again recently, and I believe that this should be the future of the Muppet films again. It's just A Christmas Carol, but done with Muppets, and Michael Caine plays Ebenezer Scrooge. Kermit the Frog is Bob Cratchit. Gonzo is Charles Dickens, with Rizzo the Rat as just a sidekick following around. It's a fun, clever way to tell a Christmas Carol. There are fun songs in it, and it's just you take a story that kind of everyone knows, and you put Muppets in it, and you find a clever way to do it, and it's fun. It's catchy. It's cute, and I think that. Really, if you want to keep the Muppet movies going, you need to sort of tap into this vein again, because otherwise the Muppet movies are dead, because Muppets Most Wanted killed it.
I would argue
Muppets,
that the Muppets also killed it, but I would be in them. I would
no,
be in
the Muppets was the Muppets was six. You would be in the minority. I like the Muppets, and you would agree that the Muppets was a success, though.
Yes,
it was a hit.
It was.
Yes, and that's my point. It was a hit, and people forgot that Muppets Most Wanted even came out this year.
I did too. I thought it was last.
That
year.
Film.
You just reminded
there you
me
go.
That's a movie that exists that came out this year.
Precisely. And I think that people don't want the Muppets to go away. People like the Muppets. But I think that this should be its future, is trying to find ways to reposition these characters rather than, like, I don't know. It's much harder to send them on their own adventures. And I think really just putting them in what are essentially skits, but skits with famous stories, can, provided you give them good music, be really fun. So if you want to get a taste of what this could be, check out A Muppet Christmas Carol. Adam, what is your suggestion?
I am recommending... I do like A Muppet's Christmas Carol. I think that is a very good Muppets movie. Though I will say Scrooge is probably my favorite Christmas Carol iteration.
We don't have to compare.
Come on, Bill Murray versus
they're not a competition,
Muppets?
Adam.
Come on.
It's not a competition.
That would make for an interesting double feature, though. I don't know which one you'd want to start with, the deeply dark and depressing one or the Muppets.
I thought you were going to say, or Scrooge.
My recommendation is a movie that opened in limited release over Christmas, but is getting ready to open wide, and everyone should see it, and it is Selma. This is a movie you might have read my top 10 list. I named it as the best film of the year. It's my favorite movie of the year. It's a film that, I mean, this is a moment in time. If you don't know what Selma is, it's about the 1965 march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, which was a series of protest marches that led to Lyndon B. Johnson signing the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was struck down this year by Congress, saying that racism is over. Racism doesn't exist anymore.
By the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Was that last year or this year? I can't remember.
I think it was this year.
Racism is over, according to the Supreme Court. So, But yeah, Selma is from filmmaker Ava DuVernay, who is an independent filmmaker. She's known more for she did Middle of Nowhere, but this movie is explosive and bold and incredible, and it is not a biopic. It is about Martin Luther King Jr. was intimately involved in the Selma March. He went down to Selma, Alabama, to help the SELC and SNCC, and try and you know, help these marches go on and help fight for President Johnson to sign some sort of Voting Rights Act, because he was pushing back on it. He didn't want to do it. He wanted to try and convince Congress to do it himself. And so Martin Luther King Jr. went down there. But it offers a complex portrayal of Dr. King that we haven't seen before, and it's the kind of it's not a biopic, but if you are approaching it as a biopic, it's the kind of biopic you want to make, because it focuses on a moment in time in his life as opposed to trying to do a cradle to grave. But the story really isn't about Dr. King. It's about change. It's about how change occurs. It's about the compromise, the fight, the uphill battle, the difficulty of making true change and how it happens. As opposed to just being like, oh, and you know, someone was courageous and things got better. That's not really how things work. David Oyelowo is incredible as Martin Luther King. Tom Wilkinson is very good as Lyndon B. Johnson. It has an incredible supporting cast. Wendell Pierce from The Wire, Lorraine Toussaint. Oprah Winfrey is really great. She's in a couple of scenes. Keith Stanfield from Short Term 12 is in it. But the most striking in the thing that maybe I guess surprised me most about the film is that Ava DuVernay shoots it in a way, and her focus of the film positions it in a modern context. This isn't a historical drama. It doesn't feel like here's something that happened a while ago that was interesting. It feels of its time, but of our time. Bradford Young's cinematography is fantastic and visceral and great. He frames Dr. King from behind a lot. It was really surprising for me, and it's really great, and I really hope everyone sees it, because it's an incredible film, and I want it to do well, because I think it's an important film as well. And Ava DuVernay is so good. Her direction is so incredible. It's hard to do that kind of thing. To paint an historical event in a modern context, to make it feel like these characters aren't in a time capsule or, you know, in the past, and she does it fantastically and makes the film feel relevant. So Selma, it opens wide on January 9th. Go see it in a theater near you. You will not be disappointed.
Agreed. Well, thank you for listening, everyone. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you?
At Adam Chitwood.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you in 2015.